After a week of escalating violence, the scene in Ferguson, Missouri on Thursday night was one of relative calm as protesters marched with police officers down the streets of the St. Louis suburb. Here's Captain Ronald Johnson of the Missouri Highway Patrol, now Ferguson Police Commander.
And if that was my son or that was my friend, how would I feel and what my emotions would be? And whatever my voice was, I want to have the right to say what that voice is. And that's what we're going to do here today and every day forward.
The tone stood in stark contrast to the days and nights of confrontation between demonstrators, mostly peaceful but angry, and police, often in riot gear, often seen holding military rifles on armored vehicles or firing off tear gas. The cause of the conflict was the shooting death of an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, by a police officer on August 9th. Since then, Ferguson has been headline news, documented minute by minute via tweets, vines, and live streams.
You may no longer be in the area. It is no longer a peaceful protest.
Go shoot! Go shoot!
They are firing rubber bullets and smoke grenades.
Tremaine Lee, national reporter for MSNBC, has been reporting from Ferguson since Monday, August 11th. We spoke to him earlier this week and asked him about the view from what's being called Ferguson.
Wednesday night was the worst night so far. Police officers hurled canisters of tear gas into the crowd. They also launched flash grenades, bang grenades. It was the kind of sight that I understand why people could look at this from around the world and around the country and say it looks like a war zone. And that's how it felt. People running and screaming, their eyes burning, some people vomiting. It's quite a sight, especially in a small city in the Midwest.
And in fact, the Washington Post's Mark Berman wrote that the notion of something playing out on social media is a tiresome platitude at this point. But what's playing out in Ferguson, he said, seems different in that it evokes situations that have happened in other parts of the world. And actually, what we're seeing online does seem to smack of the live reporting during the Arab Spring, right? Citizens posting live streams, people who, by their tweeting on the ground, are becoming familiar names.
This case, and at least my personal experience, has been an experience like no other. Everything is going viral because we haven't seen this level of, I'll call it rebellion, in a long time. Some young people say they've been waiting for a moment like this where they can express themselves, whether they do it peacefully or violently. The death of this young man in this community by a police department that they say has been harassing them for years, they finally now are saying enough is enough. And the consequences, we have burned out stores. We have a militarized police department that have shown up in mass and actually escalated the tension in this community, escalated the violence. But again, it's all playing out before our eyes, all playing out on Twitter and social media, and everyone seems to be participating and watching.
Yeah, I mean, there's an alderman who I never would have had occasion to know about named Antonio French, who seems to be everywhere all the time, uninflectedly reporting the events as they happen. And then you have a reporter like Wesley Lowry of The Washington Post, who's getting arrested, and his last remark is, tweet this.
Wesley Lowry is a colleague. He's a great young journalist. And so we were at one of the press conferences on Monday, and he's firing away on his cell phone, tweeting about it. And the people have a hunger because that's where they're getting their information. But going back to that alderman, he's been here. He's been tweeting and covering the story in a way that the local news media hadn't even been covering it in. And so as he's getting hauled away to jail, they're tweeting about it. As Wesley is getting hauled away to jail, and his last words saying, you know, tweet about it, tweet it out. It's a different world, as we all know, and especially folks in the media or have been following the media. Years ago, there was the Gen 6 case in Gen, Louisiana, where a group of young black teenagers, high school students, were charged with attempted murder for beating up one of their young white peers. People from around the country amassed, one of the first times that this young generation mobilized, but we still weren't using Twitter or Facebook that much. Then you jump years later to 2012, to the Trayvon Martin case, when it was all over social media and it expanded and grew. People were using online petitions. People were tweeting and Facebooking. But the images emerging from here in Ferguson, Missouri, are unlike anything we've ever seen, because people in the Trayvon Martin case were gathering by the thousands in an open field, pretty much contained. But here, as the police seem to be beating back a force of mostly peaceful protesters, and their tear gas canisters are flying in, and you're seeing these images in real time. I was on one side street, and I watched as a man was going to open his front door with his keys. So as he's walking across the front lawn, there was a police officer with his rifle trained on him, following him to his front door. All these images are now being blasted across the country.
It's interesting how social media is speaking back to mainstream media. The day after the shooting, NBC News tweeted a picture of Michael Brown, expressionless, wearing a basketball jersey, making what some commentators called a gang sign. And then came the hashtag, if they gunned me down. People of color have been tweeting pairs of photos of themselves with the question, which photo would they use? They have a picture of themselves in a hoodie and then say in their Marine dress uniform. Are the mainstream media getting the message that they need to be more judicious in what photos they choose?
I think how we're choosing our photos and images we're putting out there is still a direct reflection of the diversity in the newsroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been a journalist for 10 years, and almost every newsroom I've been in, you look around and I'm the only person of color. And that doesn't necessarily give me some sort of wisdom into...
Tremaine, it kind of does.
I guess it does. I mean, that's what diversity is about, right? But I think when we look around and we see these newsrooms that are still so homogenous, and so when they see this young man, hey, it looks fine to me. This is how they look. It's almost like when we talk about violence is normalized in the media and normalized by law enforcement, it's supposed to happen in these places. And so we view everything from that context. And I think in the media sometimes, in these homogenous newsrooms, look at it and say, I don't see the problem. This is what they look like. Look what part of town he came from.
In a piece for Medium, Cord Jefferson wrote about his frustration and exhaustion with covering what he called the racism beat. I used to think that maybe I'd let my anger serve as an engine, he wrote. But I've since discovered that my anger over each new racist incident is now rivaled and augmented by the anger I feel when I am asked to explain once more why black people shouldn't be brutalized, insulted, and killed. He's pretty much walked away from this. And I wonder, you've been on this beat. You were one of the first on the Trayvon Martin so-called Stand Your Ground shooting in Florida. Is it getting to you?
Does it weigh on you? Certainly. But is there some responsibility to do so as a journalist and also as a black journalist? Most definitely. Wednesday night, I get back to the hotel after choking on tear gas and witnessing people scurrying for what some of them believe is their lives. And I come into the bar, they're drinking, everything seems so good, but it's not good. And you look around and everyone in that room is white. And you know, there's a whole community here that has been suffering for a long time. And you know, this is replicated. It's Ferguson here. It's Sanford, Florida, where Trayvon Martin was killed. It's East New York in Brooklyn. It's Chicago. We live in these kind of completely different worlds. And so as a black journalist who is tasked with trying to go out and tell the stories about, again, how we live and how we die and how Americans suffer and how we overcome and how our institutions have failed us, it does weigh on you. But if not me, who else? You know, if not Wesley Lowery, who else? If not Yamiche Alcindor or all the black journalists who came before us, who had to do their jobs under even harsher conditions, I'm not sure who would. But again, we're here as journalists. This is what we're paid to do. Some of it sometimes is mission-driven because you can see a truth that some others can't see. And as I'm sitting out here talking, then some of these people will trust me because they'll see a brother in me and I can see the same in them and we can talk openly and honestly and I can get the truth. That's important. So I don't take it for granted.
We had you on the show in March of 2012 to talk about Trayvon Martin. And I asked you what you wanted out of that coverage. And here's a clip of your answer.
I would like to see this the beginning of a conversation. I'm certainly interested in seeing where this goes. I wonder if this ultimately is this watershed moment that we all believe it will be and how we'll all be changed. I think we're all going to be a little different after this.
So are we at least a little different?
I think we are a little different. Since the killing of Trayvon Martin, you've had the killing of Jordan Davis in Jacksonville, Florida, by someone who began an altercation with this young man over his loud music and fired into his car. You've had the Radisha McBride case in Detroit, where a young woman showed up at someone's doorstep and they fired a shotgun through a screen door and tore off half of her face. Jonathan Ferrell in Charlotte, North Carolina, he gets in a car accident. He shows up at someone's door looking for help. She called the police. They end up gunning this young man down, again, unarmed. Eric Garner, more recently in New York City, selling loose cigarettes, died in a police chokehold. In each one of these cases, there was a mass of media around it. these stories went viral. We can go case by case and city by city, and people know their names. In the past, I don't think we would have cared enough. I don't think we would have had the capital to do this. On top of President Obama in his watershed moment in the Trayvon Martin case, where he finally opened up and talked about race, how we value or don't value black men's lives in America. That all matters. And I think the Trayvon Martin case did that. The saddest part is news organizations hop on top of this, peel away the layer and analyze it from every single angle. But I'm not sure where it makes a difference. With stop and frisk, that's kind of in its last vestiges. But now we have the broken window policing, where we're seeing the same results. Black and brown men ground out into powder and pushed into the system. Standing ground laws. People dug in harder in Florida to maintain those laws that seem to allow people to form their vendetta mentality. But we are different. The world is more receptive to these ideas of how our system created this framework around particularly black and brown men. There are lethal consequences, and we're all kind of indicted in it because we all play a role, because we've all normalized it. We recognize it, but now what? Hopefully in a couple of years, the conversation we'll be having will be much different. You know, I wouldn't put any money on it, but let's hope.
Tremaine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Glenn.
Tremaine Lee is national reporter for MSNBC, now in Ferguson, Missouri.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.